world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. Hi, I'm Mike.
And I'm Sarah from Long Island, New York.
And we're here with four of our six children, and we want to say hi to our two oldest at Liberty University.
Hi, Ben and Sam. We hope you enjoy today's program.
I love you.
Good morning. The Biden administration moves to make abortion pills widely available. How will the pro-life side respond?
The battle never stops. Complacency is exactly what evil wants.
Also today, the White House is expanding legal options for immigrants to enter the United States. Plus, two philosophers debate a very old question.
There is the possibility of finding out a truth by experiment. And that seems to me to assume an ordered and intelligible universe.
And training camp for boys who will someday be men.
It's Tuesday, January 24th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Now news with Kent Covington.
House Republicans are asking the Secret Service for information about who visited President Biden's Delaware home where the FBI found classified documents. Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer.
We formally sent requests to the Secret Service about any communication or documents that would give us an idea of who actually had access to that house.
The White House has told lawmakers that there are no visitor logs for the home because it's a private residence. Investigators this week found another batch of classified documents at the home, including some dating back to Biden's time in the U.S. Senate. Meantime, a showdown is brewing in the House between the Speaker and Minority Leader. World's Kristen Flavin explains.
In 2021, House Democrats stripped two GOP lawmakers of committee posts over controversial remarks and online posts. In turn, Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has vowed to block three Democrats from committees, Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, and Ilhan Omar. McCarthy said Schiff, quote, lied to the American public during Trump impeachment proceedings. He also noted Swalwell's past ties to a former Chinese spy and remarks by Omar that some in both parties called anti-Semitic. But Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is defiantly renominating Congressman Schiff and Swalwell to the Intel Committee. He said both deserve to sit on the panel. Omar is expected to be renominated to serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee. For World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Police are still looking for a motive in the shooting attack on a Los Angeles area dance hall where patrons gathered to celebrate the Lunar New Year. Another victim died from injuries at the hospital, bringing the death toll to 11. Scott Weiss is police chief of Monterey Park, California.
My individual officers would like to know why. I know the families want to know why. The why is a big part of this.
Authorities identified the gunman as a 72-year-old Vietnamese man. They say he frequented the dance hall where he opened fire. His ex-wife told CNN that was where they first met. Poland says it will ask Germany for permission to send German-made Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki says with or without Berlin's blessing, Poland and a coalition of other countries would send their German-built tanks to Ukraine. Germany has been reluctant to send its own tanks, but said this week that it won't stand in the way if other nations choose to supply Leopard 2 tanks to Kyiv. Jurors are now hearing the case against former Mexican safety chief Genaro Garcia Luna. The U.S. government accuses him of taking bribes from the drug cartels he was supposed to take down. World's Josh Schumacher has more.
Prosecutors say that Luna accepted briefcases full of cash to look the other way as the Sinaloa cartel smuggled tons of cocaine into the United States. Prosecutors also argue that Luna guaranteed the cartel information on investigations, smooth passage for its cocaine through police checkpoints, and sometimes even law enforcement badges for cartel members. Luna's officers are accused of hand-delivering drug shipments from airports and acting as mercenaries, killing people on behalf of the cartel. Luna insists he is innocent. For World, I'm Josh Schumacher.
With the price of eggs through the roof, a farmer-led advocacy group is accusing the country's dominant egg producers of price collusion. Egg producers say an outbreak of the avian flu is to blame for skyrocketing prices, but the group Farm Action says that is merely a convenient excuse. It penned a letter to the Federal Trade Commission making the case that major corporations cut a backroom deal to hike prices. During an outbreak of the bird flu in 2015, prices doubled. But during the current outbreak, average egg prices have nearly tripled from $1.79 in December 2021 to $4.25 one year later. Attorney General Merrick Garland on Tuesday outlined efforts to fight pro-life laws in states across the country. He said the administration's abortion rights task force continues its work.
The task force is also evaluating appropriate actions in response to those laws, including filing affirmative suits, filing statements of interest, and intervening in private litigation.
His remarks follow Vice President Kamala Harris's Sunday speech on the 50th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, in which Harris attempted to tie abortion rights to America's founding documents.
A promise we made in the Declaration of Independence, that we are each endowed with the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
But many quickly picked up on the missing words in her remarks, specifically endowed by their creator and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, how the pro-life movement is changing, plus expanded legal options for immigrants entering the United States. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Tuesday, the 24th of January, 2023. So glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. First up, what is next for the pro-life movement? Pro-lifers rallied at last week's March for Life in Washington, D.C., celebrating the end of Roe v. Wade, but they also have their eyes on the future and are preparing to defend preborn life from aggressive new threats. World's Leo Briceno reports from Washington.
For the first time in the 50-year history of the March for Life, thousands of pro-life advocates returned last week to the capital of a post-Roe United States. The end of Roe v. Wade changed the focus of the event and of the pro-life movement as a whole. Lynn Fitch is the Attorney General of Mississippi and one of the architects of the Dobbs v. Jackson case in which the Supreme Court overturned Roe. She told the crowd at the March for Life,
"But this year is different. We have overturned Roe v. Wade with the Mississippi Dobbs case. We have done it. We can protect life, but this is not the end of our journey."
It's now been 7 months since the Supreme Court released its decision in the Dobbs case, ending a federally protected right to an abortion. In that time, both the pro-life movement and abortion activists have zeroed in on shoring up support at the local level. The ruling made states, the key governing bodies, deciding whether abortion will remain permissible and what protections, if any, would be put in place for life in the womb. That's changed the conversation on abortion from one struggle at the Supreme Court to 50 different battlegrounds across state capitals. Ryan Bomberger, the founder of the Pro-Life Radiance Foundation and a speaker at the 2023 March for Life, says the focus has to be different now.
The battle never stops. I mean, complacency is exactly what evil wants. It wants us to feel this false confidence that it's over. But this will be a continual battle because on the federal level, this is what can happen.
Similarly, Congressman Chris Smith from New Jersey, another one of the speakers at the march, charged the states with taking up the pro-life movement.
Also, thank you to Justice Alito for writing a brilliant decision, brilliant opinion. And what he did was to convey to lawmakers at the federal, state, and local level to regulate or prohibit abortion. We have an engraved invitation to protect life.
Following the March for Life, abortion advocates also pointed to changes in their own messaging. They are focusing on expanding the availability of abortion drugs and calling for Congress to legislate abortion rights. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke to abortion supporters Saturday in Tallahassee, Florida.
For nearly 50 years, Americans relied on the rights that Roe protected. Today, however, on what would have been its 50th anniversary, we speak of the Roe decision in the past tense.
Even before the march, Biden's Department of Justice published a memo arguing that the U.S. Postal Service should still be able to mail abortion pills into states where abortion is legal without incurring legal culpability. It's tactics like these that have narrowed the focus of the conversation on abortion to how women seeking abortions can get around pro-life laws.
Members of our cabinet and our administration are now directed, as of the president's order, to identify barriers to access to prescription medication and to recommend actions to make sure that doctors can legally prescribe, that pharmacies can dispense, and that women can secure safe and effective medication.
Many key Democratic figures have also called for Congress to do what Roe v. Wade couldn't, cement abortion as a federally protected right in legislation. That's why, says Bomberger, Christians and specifically churches need to be involved and aware of what's going on in the legislative theater now more than ever.
Context, whether it's a Christian audience or it's a secular audience, we have to be willing to provide some of that context so that people understand better, they can make these connections and understand what's really at stake.
Reporting for World, I'm Leo Briseno.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, new programs for sponsoring immigrants. Last April, the Biden administration announced a private sponsorship program called Uniting for Ukraine. It allows permanent U.S. residents to sponsor Ukrainian refugees to live in the United States for 2 years.
Then in October, the president announced a similar program for Venezuelans. It's an effort to encourage people to fly into airports instead of crossing illegally over the border. A few months later, the administration expanded that option to Cubans, Nicaraguans, and Haitians, and then last week rolled out the Welcome Corps, a program for sponsors in the U.S. to resettle refugees from around the world.
World's reporter on the Compassion Beat, Addie Offrens, is here to talk about it. Addie, welcome.
Good to be here, Mary.
Well, what's the difference between these more focused sponsorship programs and the Welcome Corps?
Yeah, Mary, there's an important distinction there, and it comes down to an immigrant status. The Welcome Corps allows five or more adult U.S. residents to sponsor an already approved refugee and help them resettle in the United States. This expands the United States' capacity to resettle refugees from just 9 large nonprofits who usually are in charge of this process. Refugees are processed and vetted for permanent residency before they enter the U.S., and they also have a path to citizenship. Kit Taintor is Vice President of Policy and Practice at Welcome.us. That's an organization that works to connect sponsors and immigrants. Here's Taintor. She refers to USCIS, which is United States Citizenship and Immigration Services.
And these paths sort of solve different problems. As you may know, there's 24 million refugees in the world. Some of them have been waiting decades in a refugee camp or an urban center to have an opportunity to resettle in the United States. What Welcome Corps does is it responds to that need to increase the capacity of nations like the United States to accept and to support more refugees. What the USCIS humanitarian parole sponsorship programs do is they allow us to be a little bit more agile and respond to emergent needs. So Uniting for Ukraine is a great example.
Sponsorship programs for specific nationalities like Ukrainians or Venezuelans are aimed at getting people processed into the United States quickly on humanitarian parole. This is a temporary 2-year status designed to address urgent humanitarian needs around the world. This is different from refugee status, which takes longer, but comes with a path to citizenship.
Who are the sponsors then?
Yeah, Mary, they're really just ordinary Americans or other immigrants with residency in the United States. Some are extended family of the person they're sponsoring. Or some are just ordinary families who wanted to help out, like Joe and Sandra Kutschall. They sponsored a Ukrainian family after the war broke out through the Uniting for Ukraine program. They're empty nesters from Ida Grove, Iowa, a community of about 2,000 people. The Ukrainian family lived with the Kutschalls for about 10 weeks. Here's Joe.
It's a house that was built in the 40s, and it's not a real big house, but it has basically a bedroom upstairs and two bedrooms down. So they stayed in the upstairs bedroom. So they rented a house, which is just a few blocks away.
They see sponsorship as a ministry, as well as a way to breathe new life into their tiny community.
We do support missionaries and missions and all that, but we're not the ones to go. So we're the ones to have people come. And we can open our home and our resources for them.
There's jobs here. And so, you know, to bring people to fill those jobs and to fill our community. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of younger people move out of rural Iowa. It's good life, but there's always something else somewhere.
So I'll give you another example of sponsorship. Saranjel Rojas and her husband are from Venezuela. They sponsored her 32-year-old nephew, Junior Navarro, so he could join them in Austin, Texas. Their whole process took about a month. He got here on December 24th.
So Christmas Eve, how does the process work, Addie? What do sponsors have to do?
So to sponsor someone on temporary humanitarian parole, a sponsor has to show that they can financially support the beneficiary. Brian and Sandy Penley sponsored a Ukrainian couple in their 20s and their 4-year-old daughter. They got connected through a Facebook group for Ukrainians in Austin. Here's the couple describing the process.
Twofold. You fill out our side from the sponsor's side that says we're committed to them for 2 years. And, you know, because you hear some stories of some of them, they say that they get over here and they're abandoned. You know, that's terrible.
And so what we owned, and we had to prove a lot of stuff, and then didn't take but a week for the government to approve us. And then they send a message to them, and then they have to fill out all these forms to send them. And then, like Brian said, then they give them the approval to travel.
Well, for immigrants on temporary parole programs, what happens when the 2 years are up?
Yeah, Mary. So for many Afghans, Ukrainians, and now Central and South Americans, that's a big question. Like I mentioned before, unlike refugee status, humanitarian parole doesn't give permanent residency or include a pathway to citizenship. So immigrants on parole must get in line for asylum, a process that could take years. Another option is for Congress to pass an Adjustment Act, which would provide a pathway to citizenship for immigrants on parole.
Addie Offrens is World's reporter on the Compassion Beat. To keep up with her immigration coverage and more, head over to WNG.org and sign up for Addie's weekly newsletter called Compassion. Addie, thank you.
You're welcome, Mary.
Additional support comes from The Light FM, a radio ministry founded by Billy Graham, featuring contemporary Christian music and sound Bible teaching. More at thelightfm.org/world. And from Covenant College, a distinctly Christian liberal arts college on beautiful Lookout Mountain, Georgia. More at covenant.edu.
Mary, I hope you're in the right frame of mind. Have you heard about Toadzilla?
No!
It's alive! A gigantic beast stalking the earth.
So appropriate because, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. Rangers in Australia last week discovered a massive amphibian hiding deep in the rainforest of Conwy National Park in Queensland.
Is this the end of our civilization?
Okay, maybe that's stretching it just a bit. It's not quite that bad, but rangers do say that Toadzilla earned his name. He's a 6-pound cane toad, you know, like sugar cane. And he's probably the biggest cane toad ever recorded, twice as big as the second biggest.
Incredible! Unbelievable! A story beyond your wildest dreams!
So, of course, Toadzilla had to go. He's an invasive species, and if he hung around very long, he'd end up destroying the park. Now, by way of background, the cane toad was brought to Australia back in the 30s to combat the cane beetle, but now it has become the pest.
Can the scientists of the world find a way to stop this creature?
Well, as it turns out, the Queensland Museum is interested in trying to find a way to stop this creature. It has offered to take Toadzilla for further study, it says. Oh. Now, what could possibly go wrong? It's the world and everything in it.
It's Tuesday, January 24th. So glad you've turned to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, the existence of God. On January 28th, 1948, two prominent philosophers squared off on the BBC, Bertrand Russell and Frederick Copleston. Russell was an agnostic, a mathematician, one of the most famous intellectuals of his day, and Copleston was a Jesuit priest who had written a 9-volume history of philosophy.
That date you mentioned was 75 years ago this week. That's when they met to debate the question, does God exist? Here's World's Anna Johansson Brown.
Somebody once asked Bertrand Russell this question. If you were to die, and it turns out that you've been wrong about everything, that God does exist, and you do have an eternal soul, and you show up in front of God for judgment, what will you say for yourself? Russell replied, "Not enough evidence." In 1948, at age 76, Russell is a well-established agnostic. He doesn't believe you can prove or disprove the existence of God. That means it's up to Frederick Copleston to make his case first.
Suppose that I give a brief statement of the metaphysical argument, and then we go on to discuss it.
That seems to be a very good plan.
Copleston's first argument is the argument from contingency. He points out that everything in the world depends on something else for its existence. Life doesn't spontaneously generate. It requires a cause. People aren't self-sufficient. They need food and water and air. According to Copleston, that indicates the universe itself depends on something, or someone.
Therefore, I should say, since objects or events exist, and since no object of experience contains within itself the reason of its existence, this reason, the totality of objects, must have a reason external to itself, and that reason must be an existent being.
I think it's a very strong argument.
That's Dr. Matthew Roberts, professor of philosophy at Patrick Henry College.
But essentially the idea is that there must be some reason why there is anything at all. Why is there something rather than nothing?
Copleston's argument is that something caused the universe to exist. The next question then is, what caused that cause? Of course, Roberts says, the God of creation doesn't have a cause.
The classical Christian theistic response is that God's nature is to exist. This is part of God's eternality, his beginninglessness and his endlessness.
Bertrand Russell doesn't buy that.
That seems to me to be impossible.
Russell does believe that some things can exist independently. He just doesn't think that beings can do that. Here's Matthew Roberts.
He thought, like Plato, that there are these things, like numbers, that exist eternally without beginning. Nothing creates nor destroys the number 7. It just is. So it's a little bit puzzling that he would say this. Surely if numbers can exist by themselves or uncaused, then other beings might, namely God.
But even beyond that, Russell doesn't think there is an explanation for the universe at all. And he doesn't think there's any point in talking about it.
I should say that the universe is just there, and that's all.
Copleston says that is a possibility, but it doesn't fit with what we see in the rest of the world.
There is the possibility of finding out a truth by experiment, and that seems to me to assume an ordered and intelligible universe.
Matthew Roberts agrees.
Certainly, psychologically, we are much more drawn to the idea that it has an explanation. Now, that might just be a product of our psychology. We prefer things to make sense. Fair enough. But everything else about the universe does seem to point towards rational comprehensibility.
He says, with so many other explanations in the world, laws of physics, biology, chemistry, it would be strange for the one ultimate question to not have an answer. At this point in the debate, Copleston gets a little frustrated.
But your general point then, Lord Russell, is that it's illegitimate even to ask the question of the cause of the world.
Yes, that's my position.
Well, if it's a question that for you has no meaning, it's of course very difficult to discuss it, isn't it?
Yes, it is very difficult. What do you say? Shall we pass on to some other issue?
Let's.
So they move on to talk about personal spiritual experiences. Copleston believes that those experiences indicate the presence of a divine being, revealing himself to people individually. Finally, Copleston brings up his last main point, the moral argument.
The vast majority of the human race make and always have made some distinction between right and wrong.
Copleston says that indicates a moral lawgiver, some objective standard to determine good and evil. Russell does believe in good and evil, but he doesn't have an explanation for where those morals come from.
I don't have any justification, any more than I have when I distinguish between blue and yellow. What is my justification for distinguishing between blue and yellow? I can see they're different.
Well, that is an excellent justification, I agree. You distinguish blue and yellow by seeing them. So you distinguish good and bad by what faculty?
By my feelings.
Copleston says that's not good enough. He brings up the Holocaust, the commanders of concentration camps who committed unspeakable crimes. In 1948, the specter of Nazi Germany is still fresh.
That appears to you as undesirable and evil, and to me too. To Adolf Hitler, we suppose, it appeared as something good and desirable. So I suppose you'd have to admit that for Hitler it was good, and for you it is evil. But that's my point. I don't approve of them, and I know you don't approve of them, but I don't see what ground you have for not approving of them.
Yes, but you see, I don't need any more ground in that case than I do in the case of color perception.
Philosophers disagree on who won the Copleston-Russell debate. Both speakers gave closing statements reiterating their positions and went their separate ways. But even though there wasn't a clear winner, Matthew Roberts says it's still valuable for Christians to think about these arguments, not just so we can give an answer to skeptics, but for our own personal walks with God.
The more reasons you have to believe Christianity is true, the stronger your faith can become, particularly in moments of great trial. In other words, the life of the mind is really critical to anchoring ourselves in our relationship with God.
And Roberts has a bone to pick with Bertrand Russell. Christianity, he says, has plenty of evidence.
I think it is actually the most rationally defensible, evidentially defensible worldview religion on the planet. So I would be happy to go toe-to-toe with Russell on that point.
Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson-Brown.
Today is Tuesday, January 24th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. World commentator Whitney Williams now on the Christmas present she didn't get.
All I wanted for Christmas was for my three sons to stop bickering with one another. And I told them so.
Stop acting like you're way smarter than Luke. It's annoying.
Stop acting like that.
And you are, you're like, how do you know that?
Instead, I received a plaid lumberjack-looking shirt jackety thing from Amazon. I just learned cool people call this a shacket. Some Kendra Scott earrings, a massage gift certificate, and two packs of Sour Punch straws. A pretty good haul, I'd say, considering my true Christmas wish was a pipe dream. After opening presents together, our family of five loaded up in the van for a Christmas Eve service at my grandparents' church. Not 5 minutes into the drive, our sons started fighting with one another. I took a deep breath, let out a long sigh, and zoned out, like any great Christian parent would. One can only live up to Paul Tripp parenting standards so many times in a week. One of my 5-year-olds' screams jogged me out of my fog. Remember Mom's Christmas! I smiled and took heart. A Bible passage I'd read with my husband a week prior reminded me that I wasn't the only parent beaten down by bickering brothers. Just listen to what happened when Jesse sent his youngest son, David, to bring supplies to his three elder brothers fighting against the Philistines and Goliath. Young David gets there, dumps the supplies at camp, and runs out to the battle line to greet his brothers. What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? David asks nearby soldiers. This does not sit well with David's oldest brother, Eliab. The Bible says his anger was kindled against David, that he got harsh with him, accusatory, not giving his little brother the benefit of the doubt. Why have you come down, David? Eliab spews. And with whom have you left those sheep in the wilderness? I know the evil of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. What have I done now, Eliab? Young David replied to his older brother. Was it not but a word? And yet, when I consider how things turn out in the chapter, I'm starting to think that a bucking big brother may have actually been God-ordained for David. A training ground of sorts to instill courage in a young shepherd boy. The kind of courage one might need to slay a giant. And perhaps God's got some giants for my boys to slay one day as well.
No, I saw it was on this first. No, I want it. No, I want
I'm Whitney Williams.
No, I want it.
You were, Jake.
Stop.
I wasn't cheating.
What's the problem?
Tomorrow, world tour, plus a conversation with former Ambassador Sam Brownback. He'll talk about international religious freedom. And with the price of eggs going through the roof, Americans are looking more seriously at backyard chickens. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Bible says Jesus came and said to the disciples, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age." Matthew 18:19-20. Go now in grace and peace.
Additional support comes from the Truce Podcast. From pyramid schemes to fundamentalism, find out how we got here and how we can do better by exploring Christian history. More at trucepodcast.com.